Good morning. All right, folks, good morning and welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. So it's great to have everyone here with us, and we have a very special class today. The class is focusing on the soul of motivation, really the soul and spirit of what I would call self-motivation, which is a theme that we need to talk about this morning, and especially keeping in mind as we get ready for the holiday season. So the as I mentioned in our last session, the self-help book section at your local bookstore, it's very populated. Lots of different titles, lots of different options as far as, you know, how a person can help themselves and grow and become better and more successful in various areas of life. Alongside that is the understanding that for a person to really change and to really get better at something, they really have to want it themselves. You can't push someone into a situation or in a position that they don't want to be in. It usually doesn't work. If you push someone into a certain thing or into a certain venture, it usually doesn't work out at the end because they don't really want it. So self-motivation is the key to success. This is true not only on a very pragmatic level when it comes to various areas of practical life, but it's also true when we talk about our spiritual life. Spiritually, when we talk about getting a spiritual connection or connection with God, the understanding is that there's only so much that someone else or something else can push us into. At the end of the day, our relationship with Hashem, with God, is dependent on ourselves and how much we want it. Now, when we talk about motivation, let's focus on an associated area, which is the notion of independence. And you'll see how I'm going to connect these two ideas in a moment. The goal, one of the goals, major overarching goals in life, is the idea of gaining independence. This is true in childhood. This is true in adulthood. In other words, the goal of an educator, let's give various examples in life where this is true. The goal of an educator is not to keep the student in a position, in a situation, where they forever need the teacher to be educated. The goal of the educator should be to educate the student, to educate the individual to the point where they become a self-standing, self-sustaining, intelligent human being, where they can learn and process and understand things on their own without needing, in a sense, to be spoon-fed the information. So although children begin in their schooling, children begin in a situation where they need to be given everything, they need to be given the information in a way that's digestible in small pieces, broken down, articulated to their level, etc. The goal of education should be to raise students to the point where they can stand intellectually on their own two feet. So this needs to be a goal in education. I can speak, so, you know, I'm a rabbi. Not only do I play one on TV, but I'm actually a rabbi. No, and I can speak to the yeshiva system, yeshiva schooling system, where in the beginning, initially, when you learn Talmud, so it's in Aramaic, like any Aramaic experts here, I mean, it's an ancient language, number one. Number two, it's written in a very unique style. The Talmudic discourse style is very unique. It's almost like you're listening in or reading a manuscript of a debate that went on, and you hear, and people are interjecting, and people are interjecting to the interjections, and debating the debates and questioning the questions, and you have to kind of figure out, well, are we at a question or an answer? Did we resolve things? Are we still things up in the air? I have no idea where we're up to, right? So it's a difficult area of study, Talmud is. Again, the language barrier, the conceptual barriers, the methodological barriers, many on different levels, it's difficult to learn. So when you first start studying Talmud, you're being given the information. The teacher is teaching you what the Talmud is saying. But then the goal is to learn enough of the vocabulary and enough of the concepts where you can open up an ancient 1,500-year-old volume of the Talmud. I don't know if the print itself is 1,500 years old, but I mean the ancient Talmudic text, and understand it, read it, understand it, make sense of it, and even in a sense, contribute to it. When I say contribute to it, what I mean is come up with questions and answers that add to the age-old scholarship of Talmud, which is still happening today. People are still writing new insights and still coming up with new ideas and publishing books and, you know, creating new interpretations, etc. So the goal is to move a student from the posture of passive recipient to active participant. And that is, again, under the general umbrella of the notion of independence. Moving a person away from dependence to independence. It's true not only when it comes to study and teaching, but it's true in every area of maturation. The goal of raising a child is to get to a point where the child is doing the right thing without being handheld, if you will, by the parent. So whereas initially parents need to, you know, need to guide the children and need to be more directly handholding, eventually the goal is that the child should stand up on their own 2 feet. So the difference between childhood and adulthood is really this distinction. The distinction between being reliant or being self-sufficient. So in other words, a goal in life is to be self-sufficient. Now, when I say self-sufficient, I don't mean to the point where we don't need anyone else and we don't need God or we don't need any support system. I don't mean that. What I mean, though, is that there's a certain independence, a certain maturation, a certain adult quality where a person is not wholly reliant on someone or something else, but rather is taking responsibility and ownership of their own stuff and achieving and accomplishing in their own way. And this strengthens the individual. One of the very interesting images that Jewish mysticism, that Kabbalah uses, is the difference between a branch or a branch that's still connected to a tree and a stick or a staff that's broken off from the tree. And again, if this doesn't play out in the botanical world, I'm preempting with my apologies, but this is what's taught at least. So a branch that's still connected still has that sort of moisture of the tree flowing through it. It's more pliant, it's softer than the branch that's broken off from the tree itself, from the tree. So once it's broken off from its source of vitality, its life, it doesn't have that moisture, that sort of life-giving flow of the tree flowing through it because it's broken off from its source, It gets stronger, it gets harder, it toughens up. So there's an advantage of being connected. When you're connected, there's an advantage because you're still plugged in, you're still connected. And it's nice to be connected. It's nice to be connected. Who doesn't want to be plugged in? It's easier when you're connected and you don't have to maintain your own existence on yourself. It's flowing through you because of something or someone else. But it's softer. It's not as tough. It's not as strong as when it is broken off from the source. In fact, there are two Hebrew biblical terms for the tribes of Israel. You know, there are 12 tribes, right? So there's two. What's the Hebrew word for tribe? Shvatim, tribes. There's another word in the biblical language for tribes. Matot. Or mateh, matot. So shvatim and matot. Staffs. A shevet and a mateh. One is a branch that's connected, and one is a staff that's been disconnected. One represents being plugged into the source, and therefore drawing strength from the source, but not having your own strength. And one represents being broken off from the source, which is painful, by the way. Right? It's difficult. the process of independence is difficult. It's disconnecting from where you were, and in a sense you could say it's losing what you had. But what you've gained is much greater, ideally, in an ideal scenario, right? What you've gained is the strength of independence. So one goal in life is independence. In fact, we had a class a few weeks ago, our Wednesday night Torah class, where we quoted from the Lubavitcher Rebbe's 70th birthday Fabrengen. And the Rebbe on that occasion spoke about the concept of work. Why is it that we work? Why did God create a scenario where we need to work for a living? Why? Couldn't God have just given us everything? So one answer is, well, no. When you work for something, you appreciate it more. So God wanted us to appreciate it, so he made us have to work for stuff. So the Rebbe asked the question, so let God have made human nature where you appreciate what you've been given and not what you've worked for. Like you can't say because it's human nature. Who created human nature to begin with? Only God created human nature. So God could have created the human being in a way that we love the handout, and then God should have given us everything. Let us, you know, live on beaches, only beach, right? Only beach chairs with those drinks with the umbrella in it, like that type of, right? Vacation life with shades all day, and the skin would be protected. There wouldn't be any illness, right? Everything would be good, and we'd whatever we need would be given to us, delivered right to our beach chair, right? Like a full end all in vacation, right? It's prepaid. It's done. They're not even hitting you up for every Coke that you're drinking. No, it's all prepaid. They're coming to your beach chair with the food, and it's all done. It's all taken care of, right? Glatt kosher, everything top notch. It's ready to go, right? Wouldn't life be amazing? So how come God didn't do this? You know why? It wouldn't be amazing because you would take it for granted. You wouldn't appreciate it. Again, the Rebbe is asking the question on his 70th birthday. He says, so God could have made it that we appreciate that. That it feels meaningful to get the handout, to have everything given to us. Why not? God could have made anything. God could have made the human being with any sort of inner nature. The Rebbe's answer was, this was 1972. So the Rebbe's answer was that God gave us the greatest gift, which is the gift of emulating him. Just like God is a giver, God wanted to give us the gift of also being a giver. When I say giver, let me clarify. Just like God is a creator and a producer, God also wanted to give us the gift of creating and producing on our own. If God would have created us where he's the only one doing the giving and creating and producing, and we sit back and we do all the taking, there would be a massive imbalance between an even greater imbalance between creator and creation, and we would never have in any way the ability to emulate God. We would be completely limited in our abilities and completely subservient to what we're getting and not be able to achieve and to accomplish and to be productive and creative. God wanted to give us the greatest gift, the gift of being partners in creation, the gift of being partners in our own existence, which is how some of the commentaries explain a very enigmatic verse in the book of Genesis. The book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis, it says that chapter 1, God says, let us make man in our image. And everyone asked the question, who's the us? Who's the our? Who's the we? How many gods are there anyway? I thought this is monotheism. What's going on here? If there's one God, right? If there's only one God doing the creating, so then what does it mean when God says, let us make man in our image? Who's the us? Who's the, huh? Let's.
Lettuce.
Oh. We're going to get you tossed soon. More salad reference. Okay. Anyway, so here's, let's get back to this point. So who's the us? Let us make man in our image after our likeness. Who's the us? Who's the our? Who's God speaking to? Is this like the royal we? It's like God just speaking of himself as like, let us. I think this is what we'll do, but he's speaking. What is this? Many different answers have been given. Dozens of answers have been given. But one answer is related to our discussion today. God is saying to the human being, let us make man. God is saying that to us, to the human being, let us make man. In other words, the making of a mensch, the making of a human being, is I'm not doing it alone. You're also responsible to make yourself a mensch. I'm going to get the process started, but you need to do the heavy lifting as well. It's not going to be a scenario where I've created you and finished you and you're ready to go. Perfect and complete, a tzaddik, a righteous person, a mensch, a noble person, an ethical person, a moral person, and there's no work to be done. That's not the case. God says, let us make man to who? To human being, to Adam and Eve. God says, you and I are going to make you into a mensch. I'm going to get it started, and I'll give you a vision of healthy living, then you need to do the work. Because in life, accomplishment happens through our efforts. Nothing worth accomplishing is ever really given to us on a silver platter without any effort whatsoever. In life, the stuff that's really good, the stuff that's meaningful, the stuff that's impactful, that's the stuff that we are at least partners in creating. We create and we do, and we are active participants in that experience. And so much of life is this process of going from dependence to independence. If you break down life into these two categories, you'll notice that much of life is the movement from dependence to independence. And it's not just about children and, you know, and going and maturing to the point where they have their own families. And it's not only about that. It's also for adults in our own life. It's about moving, you know, within work from a place of dependence to a place of creative independence. It's about, on many different levels, moving from dependence to independence is a human endeavor, and it's almost inherent to the human condition by virtue of the way God created us as independent beings. When I say independent, obviously not totally independent, not needing God, of course not. But what I mean is, at least on a surface level of productivity and that sort of thing, where we have enough independence where we are the ones forging our path and creating our way and making the choices that we need to do to be successful. So in large measure, life is about the movement toward from dependence to independence. And we find this also in a spiritual context. When the Jews left Egypt, this is a theme that we spoke about a few sessions ago, the Jewish people were utterly and completely dependent on God. They were a band of slaves, and God lifted them out of Egyptian slavery and made them into a free nation. That is not something that they did on their own. It's not like they banded together and they somehow rose up against Pharaoh and they defeated Pharaoh. And it's not what happened. They didn't gain their own independence. They were granted their own. They were granted freedom, but it wasn't self-initiated. They were crying out to God for salvation, and they certainly wanted it, but they didn't create it. God gave it to them. So that's one modality. One modality of being is where you're dependent on God rescuing you. So a person's in a bad spot, and God, sometimes, you know, maybe not often enough, this is certainly the context with the Exodus, where God swoops down, so to speak, and rescues us from the negative situation. But more often than not, that's not what happens. God is not coming in and doing a miracle and rescuing us from the situation. Rather, more often than not, God is turning to us and asking us, are we doing what we need to be doing to pick ourselves up from the situation, from where we're at and where we're stuck? That is the time of year that we're in right now. The month of El preceding, the month preceding the high holidays and Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, etc., this is a month in which we pick ourselves up and we take ourselves out of those limitations, of those difficult spots that we might find ourselves in, and get ourselves to a better place. We have, from the first day of El until Yom Kippur, we have 40 days. If you want to take the month of El and the entire month of Tishrei, we have 60 days, right? We have there's significant amount of time to get things done. This time of year, God is not swooping down like Passover to rescue us from our limitations, from our Egypt, from our pharaohs. God is looking to us that we should on our own go ahead and lift ourselves out of where we're stuck and take ourselves, bring ourselves to a better place. Which is why, fascinatingly, in the biblical count of the year, in the biblical calendar year, the first month of the year is not Tishrei. Anyone who's ever seen a Jewish calendar knows that the Jewish calendar begins with which holiday? Rosh Hashanah, right? Rosh Hashanah. Tishrei 1, the first day of Tishrei, is when the Jewish calendar begins. 5, 7, 7, 9, our calendars are running a little bit late. They'll be here soon. At least they'll be here before the new year. We're expecting them any day now. But yeah, a Jewish calendar, you open it up, the first page is usually September. Why September? Ah, there we go. That's not our, we have that also. You know, Joel, pass it down. Let me use this as a case in point. Thank you. I think this is Dressler's. Yeah. September 2018. Why September? We know why September, because that's usually where Rosh Hashanah falls out. So Rosh Hashanah this year, first day of Rosh Hashanah is Monday, September 10th. And the calendar, the Jewish calendar year will change on that day or the night before from 5778, thank you, to 5779. So by all accounts, Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah, the month of Rosh Hashanah, that should be the first month of the year. And it's not. In the biblical language, the first month of the year is the month of Nisan. The month of Passover falls out on. It's in the spring. It's usually, what is it? April? March, April? Around that time of year. So March, April, according to the Torah, to the Bible, is the first month of the year. And this month is the seventh month of the year. Makes no sense. This is the seventh month of the year. So why are we changing the calendar year at the seventh month? Understand my question? Month number one is Nisan, when Passover falls out. Month seven is Tishrei, when Rosh Hashanah falls out. So in the seventh month of the year, we're changing the year to 5779. Halfway through the year, that makes no sense. Rosh Hashanah, right? Nothing makes sense. It's the head of the year, the beginning of the year. But if the year begins in... It's a simple answer. The Talmud says that the world was created. The first day of the 6 days of creation was on the 25th day of the month of Elul. And the sixth day of creation, when Adam and Chava, when Adam and Eve were created, that day is Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei. So Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah, is the first month of creation. Natural life, hard work, working in the garden and guarding the Garden of Eden, etc. The work that we need to do, that begins on Rosh Hashanah, the birthday of Adam and Eve. What happens in Nisan, Passover? The Exodus happens, the birth of the Jewish people, where a band of slaves become extracted. The language of the prophet, God extracted one nation from the bowels of another nation, took out one nation that had been swallowed up inside of another nation, and granted them their independence and freedom, thus allowing them to become ultimately the Jewish people, formally with the code of living, with the Torah, 49 days later, 50 days later, at Mount Sinai. That all happens with the Exodus. So when it comes to miracles, the first month of miracles is Nisan. So if you're setting your calendar by when God is going to lift you up and take you out of the negative place, the miracle year begins in Nisan. But the natural year, the year of heavy lifting, us doing the hard work ourselves, of course, with the assistance of God. It's not totally ourselves, but us being self-motivated and driven to do the work that we need to do to take ourselves out of wherever we're stuck and take ourselves to a better place, that happens. That month, that experience begins in Tishrei. So you have two different years, in a sense. You have a year of miracle and a year of nature. The year of the miraculous, the supernatural, the gift from above, and then the year of hard work, perseverance, dedication, self-motivation. Two different years. Two different firsts. The first of the miracles, Passover. The first of the natural order, so to speak, right now, Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah. So this time of year, we focus not on getting saved, right? And I mean that in a Jewish way. Of getting extracted, from those tight spots, hoping and praying for a miracle. Like, God, all I need right now is for you to take me out of this place. I don't like where I'm at. I just need a sign or need a miracle or need something. It's not about that right now. This time of year is about us looking inward and asking ourselves the question, what areas of my life, of our lives, can we improve? What's working well? What's not working so well? What can we what momentum can we continue with? And what areas do we need to completely change direction and forge a new path? This time of year, it's about us motivating ourselves to be better, to be more of a mensch. Here's the problem. The goal, a major goal in life, is this independence and this self-motivation. But what happens when a person is not motivated? What happens when you see a person and all you want for them is to be motivated? You just want for them to feel that motivation and initiation and get started and get going, but they're not doing it. You're the outsider, and you're looking at them, and you love them, but you want them to take the bull by the horns and take and just begin creating and begin doing and begin lifting, whether it's practically or spiritually, whatever it is. You want them to be motivated. You want them to be self-motivated, but they're not. They're in a sense in a more passive state, waiting for something to happen, waiting for a breakthrough, waiting for an exodus, waiting to be plucked out, like those machines in the arcades for kids where you put money in and it has that mechanical arm with those very loose claws. Very loose. So the point when it grabbed the stuffed thing and you pick it up and it's ready to go, oh, whoops, it dropped it. Oh, another dollar down the drain. Right? And you spent $30 on the thing you could have bought at the Walmart or whatever it is, Target, K. Roger, wherever you're shopping. You know K. Roger? K. Roger? Kroger? Come on, guys. K. Roger. Let us. Yeah. Anyway, the point is like this. Person's waiting to be carried away, to be lifted up, to be plucked out from whatever it is that they're stuck in and rescued and dropped into the chute. No, not that. But whatever. But lifted up. And it's not happening. But you're the one looking at that and you love them and you just want them to be motivated and to be driven and to be inspired, and but they're not yet. So here's the tricky question. How do you inspire someone to be self-motivated? That's the question that we're addressing today. How do you inspire someone else to be self-motivated? It's a paradox in terms, right? It's an impossibility. Because if you're inspiring them, then that's you pulling them out. That's not being self-motivated. One would maybe posit. Is there a way to inspire someone else? Not to inspire someone else to make a change or whatever, but inspire someone else to be self-motivated. Self-motivated, you would think, needs to come from them. So how can someone else inspire someone else? How can you inspire someone else to be self-motivated?
Be an example.
Okay, good. Good.
Really, one of the best ways is where you do it in such a way that they think they came up with the idea themselves.
They're not even aware of the of your help in that process. It's like, I was just thinking now, it's like giving, you know, somebody is in need of work, and so you kind of create a scenario where you they find the job, but meanwhile you kind of orchestrate behind the scenes where they got that, but they don't even know it. They think that they found it, therefore they feel motivated and excited and they're accomplishing, but meanwhile there was a little bit of help involved in the background. Okay, good. That's one way. Another way is be a good example. Yeah.
As a parent and just as a person in a loving environment, the background, I mean, when you're loved, your natural state is to want to do.
Great. Hold that thought, because that's going to tie in a lot to our discussion today. All of the themes that we're talking about now are tying in, but that idea of love and acceptance, I'm going to add a few words to that. Acceptance and unconditional love and acceptance. That is a big piece of this. It's a big piece of this, as we'll see. And it may be counterintuitive to wanting to get someone self-motivated, but we'll see soon that that's a necessary requirement for that to happen. So now I want to turn your attention to a paper that you don't have yet. Aha. You're wondering, how are you going to know the paper if I haven't given it to you? So the whole point of today is to be self-motivated. So you need to come up with the paper. Start writing. I'm joking. I'll give it to you. I'm going to give you this as a handout. But, you know, this is the last time I'm doing this today. I'm joking. Okay. Okay. Take and pass, please.
Still stuck on K. Roger.
K. Roger. You remember K. Kruger? K. Roger. Yeah. Okay. No, it's a little bit different. Well, yeah, it is. But we didn't do the parable. I added to it. I've updated. Right.
Look at that.
So crazy. All right. I've updated the parable. Okay. So we're gonna focus here on the second half of this paper that's going around right now. If you have this paper or a similar looking paper from last week, don't worry. It's been updated. Now. It is updated. The parable has been updated. Because I cut the parable last week, halfway through. I decided to finish up the parable because I think it's cool. So here's what we're going to do now. I'm going to read the parable. I call it the parable because it's one of the most awesome parables in Kabbalah, Kabbalistic and Hasidic thought. It's a parable that pertains specifically to this month, the month that we're in right now. Today is the eighth day of the month of Elul, the last month of, well, it's either the sixth month or the 12th month. Who knows? Who's counting, right? Whatever. It's the last month, at least, of the calendar year 5778. That we can say with certainty. The last month of 5778. And today is the eighth day of that month. So in 3 weeks from, what did I say, Rosh Hashanah? Is Monday or Tuesday?
Monday.
First day is Monday?
Monday.
Folks, 3 weeks from tonight is Rosh Hashanah.
The menu is not picked yet.
Huh? I know, right? Oy, get ready to dip your apples in the honey. Okay, get your pomegranates, get your apples, but really it's about some deeper stuff as well. So 3 weeks from tonight is Rosh Hashanah, and a parable in mystical thought for this month, the month of Elul, is about a king in the field. The king is in the field. Let's read the parable, and let's explore the meaning of the parable. Here we go. This comes from Likutei Torah, Book of Discourses, by the Alter Rebbe, the founder of the Chabad Hasidic movement, in his insight on the Torah portion of Re'eh, page 32b. And he writes like this: before a king enters his city, its inhabitants go out to greet him and receive him in the field. At that time, anyone who so desires is granted permission and can approach him and greet him. He receives them all pleasantly and shows a smiling countenance to all. This is the second half of the parable. When the king goes to the city, the people follow him. But then, when he comes to his royal chamber, no one is allowed to enter without permission. And that permission is only granted to select chosen individuals. So in the parable, we have a distinction that's drawn between the situation of the king who is in the field and the king when he is in the royal city and or the capital city and in the royal chambers in the palace. So when he's in the field, so you know, I'll ask the question. What happens when the king is in the field? What's different when the king is in the field or when the king's in the palace? Help me out.
He's accessible.
Accessible. What else, Joan?
Passive. And one is aggressive.
Which one is passive? Which one is aggressive?
He's aggressive when you go out to meet him.
Okay.
And he is receptive. But when he's in his home, you have to be passive in that you don't. You can't make the first approach.
Right. You can't just knock on the king's door and say, "Hey, how's it going?"
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Good. Good. Okay, what else? So more accessible. What else did you notice in this parable? Difference between the king in the field and the king in the city.
He's in a pleasant mood.
You would think, right?
The field, and yet probably in his kingdom, he's very standoffish.
Where did you see that?
Well, I inferred it.
Well, no, it says he receives them all pleasantly and shows a smiling countenance to all. And you would imagine that when he's in the field, in a more relaxed posture, that he's pleasant and smiling, and on the throne, it's more business.
It's business.
Yeah. And kingly business is sometimes, you know, I'm kidding, I don't know, I'm not a king. But whatever, I imagine from what I've seen, you know, what I've read about.
He's working. I mean, when he's on the floor, he's working.
Yeah, he's not necessarily meeting and greeting, you know, okay,
so then good. In the field, is he connected spiritually or is he just connected from his work?
Good question. Great question. I'll ask it in the parable terms, okay, in parabolic terms. I don't know if that's a thing. But in the terms of the parable, is he wearing the royal garments? Let's put it that way. Is he wearing the crown and the robes? Does he look like the king on the throne? Right? Is he still carrying the same majesty and grandeur as he does on the in the palace on the throne, or is he a little bit more casual?
Yeah, he's dressed in
casual Fridays. Casual, yeah. Field Fridays. He's dressed down a little bit. Which one?
Dressed down.
The implication by the subsequent mystical texts that analyze this, including ours, is that he's not wearing the crown when he's out in the field. He's still the king, but he's dressed down a little bit. He's in his hiking, whatever. He's in his, you know, field attire, right? He's not in his royal attire, the full royal, you know, all of the garments. I mean, imagine, in the palace, it's air-conditioned. I don't know if it was, but work with me here. So it's air-conditioned. Out in the field, especially if you imagine this time of year, especially if you imagine the king of Atlanta, whoever that is, right? And it's schwitzing. It's like you're hot. And it's, right?
He's wearing dry fits.
Yeah, I don't know what you're wearing, but you're not wearing the whole velvet situation. I'm thinking velvet and maybe purple. Is purple royal? Purple's a royal color, right? Is it red or purple? Purple. All day, every day, right? And the crown probably has some padding involved with more velvet. It's probably really hot. If you're the king and you want to be out in the field, you're not doing that to yourself. You're like, that's it. I'm getting one of those, like, you know, smartphone handheld fans, those ones that plug into your little, right? You know what I'm talking about? You ever seen those? They make them for like the iPhone. I don't have an iPhone. So that's why I'm not so cool. Anyway, you can plug it into the little port on the phone and it turns, the power is the little fan thing. You know, a handheld fan. Anyway, so he's probably out there in the field, just, you know, more casual attire given the situation.
But he's still king.
He's still the king. Still the same guy.
People recognize him.
Still, it's not like he's the king formerly known as prince. No, as king. He's not that he's that.
Purple.
Yeah. Yes. He's you know, completely the same guy, the same king, but a little bit more casual.
But he recognizes that the roof that he's under is the roof of everyone.
He's out there amongst the people. Yes. Yes.
It's a different king.
It's a little bit of a different thing, which is what we're about to get into in our discourse text to break it down. But understand that this parable is the key to understanding how you and I, this seems like a distant parable from a mystical text about a king. Who knows kings and who? What is this? Palace and fields and Elul and Tishrei and Passover and what is this? What's going on? This right here is the key to you and I influencing anyone in a healthy way. Whether it's your child, a coworker, an employee, whatever, influence a neighbor, influencing someone in a way that you're being a positive influence and allowing them to maintain their own dignity and feel self-motivated. That trick, it's not a trick, but that Yiddish, it's a kunz, but it's not in a negative, like manipulative way. But that trick to get someone inspired to be self-motivated, that you should initiate, but they really should be the initiator. You're initiating them to be the initiator. That's all captured in this parable. But we need to unpack the parable. We need to unpack the parable. Oh, I thought you were sold. No. Yeah.
No. just two thoughts on the parable. One is that the first is easy.
In the field.
In the field is easy.
Okay.
The second is much harder.
Second's harder.
And you know.
The second's so hard that you and I may never get there. The layperson may never get there. You may never get to the point where you're granted permission.
And the other thing, to the extent that there's an order, I feel like the first part sets up the second, because there's a prelude where you're going to have the strength and the motivation to get to the king's inner chamber. There's a lot there.
You need that first move. Okay, good. Let me ask this question. When the king is in the field, and the people are seeing the king in the field. So the king is in the field, and the people are going. Okay, at that time, I'm going to read the second line again. The king is in the field. At that time, anyone who so desires is granted permission and can approach him and greet him. Who is approaching, who is deciding to approach the king? I mean, no, that's a weird way to ask the question. Let me phrase the question differently. Are the individuals that are seeing the king, are they going of their own volition or not? Are they going of their own choice or not?
Yes.
Yes. Yes or no?
Yes.
We have some strong yeses and some strong noes and maybe not sure, not sold yet on that whole. Right? In other words, the king is in the field. The king is saying, hey, I'm in the field.
But wait a minute, they're granted permission.
Does that mean that, but when they show up, when you show up to the king, is it you or is it the king? I'm asking you. What do you feel about it?
I can choose that I want to approach the king.
So who's making the choice?
I'm granted permission from the king.
Is that granting of permission? Is that pulling you, or is that just creating a scenario where then you can choose to go?
Right. Yes.
Which one? The latter. Yeah.
Granting a scenario.
Okay. Good.
The veil is lifted.
The veil is lifted.
In the field, the veil is lifted, but in the royal chambers, the veil is now down, and you have to penetrate that.
It's like the Wizard of Oz all over again. It's you have to get behind the curtain, exactly. But I want to ask you the question, where is it more alluring? Where is it more enticing? Where is it more exciting to see the king in the field or the king in the royal chamber? I have difficulty. I can understand the parable and I can even teach the parable, which I'm doing now, hopefully doing a fairly decent and a passable job at teaching the parable. But I have an emotional, and I want to get us all to a place where we're emotionally connecting to the parable and integrating the idea because it's so powerful on so many different levels. But one of the challenges with this parable is that it talks about a king. And you and I, we haven't grown up with kings. We don't know what a king is. But back in the day, a king was a spectacle. A king was a big deal. The Royal Palace, I mean, even think about England today. You go to London, right? Where do you go?
I did see the, you know, it's funny that it's that parable, but I saw the whole Rice family because I happened to cross a good street at a good moment.
I remember, yeah.
In the film. So because of that, I managed to see them all.
You saw the royal family. And you saw the queen also? The whole deal. Now, listen, so, and this was like, what, a month or two ago?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, was that the queen in the field or the queen in the palace? The queen in the field. But it's kind of like a hybrid. It wasn't necessarily.
Yeah, it was in the field on her way to the palace.
On the way to the palace.
But
she could have written this.
In England, they always stay, you know, even when they leave the palace, they always stay.
They stay dressed like royalty. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's a little bit of a hybrid of the two.
Queen.
Right. But to see back in the day, when people lived really simple lives, and that's, I mean, simple as a euphemism for really terrible lives. No, I'm serious, right? People lived like impoverished. And the king, the palace, the grand, all the wealth was concentrated in one building, one palace. And all the fortune of the kingdom, was housed in that palace. That's where it was. That's where it was held. Royal treasures, right? It's all in there. And the crown jewels and everything was concentrated there.
Shushan.
And all the,
Shushan.
All the majesty and all the glory and all the beauty and all everything, all of the greatness, it's all in one place. And behind it all, behind the curtain, behind the veil, is the king. People would yearn and pine and do anything to catch a glimpse of that in that environment. Now the king's in the field. Same king minus a lot of the pomp and circumstance, minus a lot of the accoutrements and the, you know, the ambiance. King's in the field. Simple, in the field. The king in the palace, because of the beauty and the grandeur and the majesty, and because of the exclusivity, that in a sense creates a desire and a pull to see it even more. Because when you know how beautiful it is and you know that you can't, so now what do you want? Now you want it. But when the king's in the field, accessible to all, anyone who wants. It's accessibility and availability, but it doesn't pull to the same extent as the king in the royal palace in the city. But the availability is there. The opportunity is there. And it's the opportunity, he says, is anyone. It's for all. At that time, anyone who so desires, whether, by the way, as we'll see in our text, in our discourse, in the booklet, whether you live in the city, or whether you live in the field, or whether you even live in the desert, which spiritually connotes the desert is a no man's land. It's a place devoid of Adam, of man, including Adam Ha'elyon, supernal man. In other words, it's a person in a very lowly state, would be the desert dwellers. Anyone, he says, whether you're a city slicker, or what? City slicker. Who's a Jewish guy? Wasn't there a movie, two Jewish guys on horses, city
yes.
slickers?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Gene Wilder, who was in?
No.
No.
Billy Crystal.
Yeah. That's who it was. Billy Crystal. Ah, nice Jewish boy. Okay, so you have, whether you're a city slicker or a field person, I don't have a good thing, or a desert dweller that I have also, that works, right? You have permission to go to see the king. But who chooses to go see the king? It's the individual. But how do they have the
ability? The king says that.
Oh, that's the magic. You see how we just discovered something here? In other words, in this scenario, you are going to see the king in the field. Why are you going? Because you want to. But you've been enabled to go, and in a sense set up to go, by the king making himself available and open in the field. The king never said, hey, Ari Solish, come, I'm in the field, meet me for coffee. Bring me a coffee as well. It's not the king schlepping the person. The person shows up by their own volition. And yet, the king being there in the field, the king is setting up a scenario, setting up a situation where the person is inspired. I want to use a soft inspiration, like softly inspired, subtly inspired, or
encouraged.
It's not even encouraged. It's not even inspired or encouraged. It's almost like
enabled.
Yes. Enabled to go. You see, there's a difference between calling someone forth or saying, if you do this, I am here. There's a difference. One is saying, I want you, I'm going to lift you, I'm going to pull you. The other one is saying, I'm here for you. And I'm here to accept you and embrace you when you show up. And I'm not going anywhere. So when you show up, I'm here. If the king doesn't put himself in the field, then what are the odds that the individual in the city, let alone the field, let alone the desert, is going to do the work to make it all the way to the royal palace and to get through? Very small. But the king goes out of his way to the field to make himself available, and then those that want, you see, anyone who so desires is granted permission and can approach him and greet him. Granted permission, yeah.
That troubles me.
Which part?
Granted permission.
Okay. That sounds too much top.
No, I mean, it's like, yeah, you can have a desire, but who's granting permission?
In other words, the king is granting permission. In other words, the king, by virtue of him being in the field, is giving that possibility and permission for those to greet him and meet him without having to jump through all the hoops and to get past all those barriers that otherwise would exist in the palace. In other words, in the palace, you don't have permission. In the palace, unless you're a high-ranking minister or some other, you know, nobility, some other prince from another province or whatever it is, you're probably not going to get into the royal palace. You're probably not going to get passed through those many layers of checkpoints.
Esther couldn't pass without the scepter.
Esther could, yeah. And even Esther the queen was like, you know, her life was in danger when she wanted to have a meeting with the king. Yeah.
So you're given in the field, you're given a free pass
the opportunity is there.
The opportunity exists. So that is a motivation.
It's a motivation, but a soft motivation. Yeah. That's the fine balance we're walking. It's the permission is granted means that you now have the possibility, if you choose, to see the king, and you won't be turned away. You go to the Buckingham Palace, there are those, what do they call them? The guards? That's so easy. No, don't they have a name, the guards?
Bobby.
The Bobbies.
Bobby.
Right.
Bobby.
No, not the Bobbies. Bobbies are the police. Aren't they called the bee feeder?
That's the gym.
What is that? I don't know. Anyway, whatever it is.
Royal guards.
We'll go with the royal guards. The royal guards are standing there, and you're probably not going to get through. You're probably not even going to make them smile because they're very serious in their job. Right? Famously, people try to make them laugh. But here's the bottom line. When the king is in the field, now permission is granted. Access has been granted. And the very granting of access, that itself enables the individual to be self... gives permission for a person, gives the possibility for a person to be self-motivated now to go and to approach. Because as long as the possibility is not there, if the possibility is not there, you found the
Queen's Guard.
If the possibility is not there, then you might not be motivated, especially if you're a desert dweller. Yeah.
You know, you say possibility. What comes to me is you have the, for those select people that go to the field and develop a real hunger, they now have that hunger that's going to give them that drive to do what's necessary to get to the interchange?
Some will. Some will have that hunger, and some that hunger is almost stirred inside of them by the king's presence. But someone, as we'll see inside in the actual Kabbalistic text, some who are more of the desert dweller, which in this case means someone who their lives have been, let's say, not living in concert with the king's desires, right? Those that have defied the king, for a person like that to go visit the king, the only reason that they'll do that is they're not on the level where the king inspires them. It's almost like the unconditional love of the king will enable, like you said before, will enable them on their own to seek out the king. We'll see this subtlety as we go through. Yeah.
But I think what I'm hearing is that the opportunity is there, but you still got to, you know, have the right protocol. You have to address it the proper way.
You have to show up.
You don't
is
say,
really
hey,
what's
yo.
It. Well, yeah, for sure not. But really the point is, like what you said, the possibility is there. You have to show up.
But you have to show up.
It's like the job is here. The opportunity is here. You need to show up. But I'm doing it not in a stern way, as we saw in the parable. The king is showing, receives them all pleasantly, shows them all to everybody, no matter who it is that shows up. Shows a pleasant face and a smiling countenance. That's a big piece of this, as we'll see soon.
But the more accessible he is, the less desirable it is to go see.
Yes. The less he's pulling you, the less it's him, the more it's you. That's the balance. The more accessible, the less forced it is. The less accessible, the more almost it's pulling you. Let's jump into the text because, you know, who, yeah, whatever, this is, yeah.
Part of the purpose of that is to elevate ourselves to respect God and give us an opportunity to get out of our habitual behavior,
yes. Yes.
Not going to the highest of our
goals. So what Marnine is doing is translating it down bottom line into L right now, which is good. Let's do that before we jump into chapter 3. Bottom line, like Marnine just said, if you want to translate it down into L, what it means is like this. God is saying, I believe in you. This month, before Rosh Hashanah even before, you don't have to wait for New Year's to make a New Year's resolution, even before Rosh Hashanah, 30 days, I trust in you and I believe in you and I'm right here for you and with you, that you should approach and make a change. And when you do so, God accepts it and God loves it. But it's not God who's making the change. It's you and I who are making the change and approaching in a sense. Okay, let's jump. Okay, we're going to start here on page, it's a big number, 338, chapter number 3. Chapter 3, page 338. So everybody have the page? Yes, yes? Oh, you need a copy? Yeah, of course. I have plenty of copies. Pass it, please, down to Sindri. Oh, we have all the copies. Pass it down. Thank you very much. 338, chapter 3. Yes? Yep. You guys have it?
Yep.
Yep, yep, yep. Okay. I'm going to read. Chapter 3, 338. Okay. In order to explain the two aspects of the revelation of the 13 attributes of mercy in El, mentioned above. So, just a quick background. So we explained before, previously on Kabbalah and Coffee, we explained that according to Kabbalah, the 13 attributes of divine mercy are shining in the month of Elul, in this month, 30 days. And they're shining to encourage someone to be self-motivated. Not to do it for the person, but to do it enough to encourage a person to encourage themselves, right? To inspire someone or to enable someone to be self-inspired and self-motivated. So in order to explain these two aspects of the revelation of these 13 attributes of divine mercy in El, number one, that the revelation extends to every Jew. And number two, even to those very distant from godliness, that it goes to every single person, even those far away from where they ought to be. But nevertheless, number two, the revelation does not actually arouse and motivate the person, but merely enables him. So this is the tightrope that we're trying to walk. The idea that God is reaching out to all of us where we are. No matter who we are, where we are, God is reaching out. But God is reaching out in a way that doesn't do it for us and doesn't, God is not doing the hand-holding because it's about us doing the work. So the revelation is not actually arousing, in a sense, inspiring and motivating the person, but it's just enabling, see that, using your word, your terminology, enabling him. So in order to explain this, the Maamar, the discourse in the Likutei Torah, continues by offering an analogy. And this is, of course, the parable that we just cited. Here we go. That the revelation of the 13 attributes of mercy in El can be compared to a king who appears in a field. So these 13 attributes of the divine mercy, in other words, the divine revelation, God's revelation, which is called the 13 attributes of mercy, God's revelation in this month of El is likened to the appearance of the king in the field. Let's turn the page or turn over the booklets, however you have it, to page 339 back into the translated text. Among the differences, and this is something that we broke down outside analyzing the parable, you'll see it here laid out nicely. Among the differences between a king as he appears in a field and as he appears in his palace are two fundamental matters. In other words, if we were to distinguish between the king in the field and the king in the palace, we can come away with two central ideas. Number one, A, the level of revelation is different between the two. The fundamental revelation of the splendor of the king, the glory, the grandeur, the splendor of the king, which is an intrinsic element of his sovereignty, that's not incidental to the king's sovereignty. The king banks on, right? The king cashes in on that grandeur and splendor. That's what keeps kings in power. All of the pomp and circumstance and all of the hoops that you have to get through to even see the king, right? The Wizard of Oz, it's been a while, so work with me if I get this faulty. In the Wizard of Oz, right, wasn't Dorothy and all the others, they were looking for the Wizard of Oz? And wasn't it a letdown when they finally met the Wizard of Oz? And the Wizard of Oz only had a reputation as being the wizard because no one saw the Wizard of Oz. So it's almost like that secrecy. Again, it's been a while since I walked down that yellow brick road. Right? Nelson, help me out here. All right. So it's like the reputation and the greatness of the Wizard of Oz is only because no one's ever seen him or whatever. It's because he's locked away behind the curtain, right? Mm-hmm. So he says the splendor of the king in the small text over there, right in the middle of 339, is an intrinsic element of his sovereignty. It's not incidental. It's not like, well, the king is the king and also the king likes to dress up. No. The king's grandeur and all of the limitations and all of the accessibility restrictions, that all feeds into the power of the king. The king is powerful in part because it's so difficult to get to the king. That's the way it is. By the way, something that's very special and treasured, you put behind doors and you put behind curtains and doors. And I reference right here in this room. The holiest item, besides for you and I, of course, who possess souls that are a piece of God himself, but as outside of us, the next holiest item in this room is the Sefer Torah, the Torah scroll. Why do we put it in a box behind the curtain? For the same reason. Because it's special, and because when you put something behind closed doors and behind curtains, it adds to the allure. It makes it more special. It makes it more, when you open up, ooh, right, it's beautiful. There's maybe a spot. I don't think we have a spotlight in here, but some synagogues, there's a spotlight, and you open it up, and it's glittering, and there's crowns, right? The Torah, we treat like royalty. It has a mantle, like a robe, the cover. It has a crown on the Torah, right? Mm-hmm. The Torah is like royalty. It's not like royalty. It's Jewish royalty. It's not of the flesh and blood kind, but it's of the... Also, another reason why we keep it behind doors is because we have a safer Torah, safer Torah. Anyway, it's a pun. In Hebrew, safer Torah means Torah scroll, but safer also means safer. Okay. Yeah, that's on the bagels. Put locks on the bagels sometimes. Not this morning, apparently.
We met your match.
We did. Steve. Oh, Steve is.
He's not. His match.
No, Steve is right up there. I mean, I put him a close second.
Yeah. Never heard that.
He's taught me. No, he's taught me everything that I know. Okay, so again, two. Come Shabbos. It's a lot of fun. After the service, services are also fun, but also after the service. Okay, so again, number one, the level of revelation is different between whether the king is in the palace or in the field. And again, I'm just going to read it again. A, the level of revelation, the fundamental revelation of the splendor of the king, which is an intrinsic element of his sovereignty, as is indicated by the verse, your eyes shall behold the king in his splendor. In other words, it's important that the people who are subjugated, if you will, to the king, that they are seeing the king, or they know that the king has the splendor of majesty, that makes the king a king. Otherwise, the king is diminished in their eyes. So the splendor is an important aspect. That happens where? In his palace. Not when he, that's why I said the way we understand the parable is that when he's in the field, he's wearing more casual clothing, because otherwise there wouldn't be this distinction. He's saying there is this distinction, which means that the crown and the robe and the scepter and certainly the curtains and the doors and the chambers and the locks and the guards and all of that stuff are in the palace and not in the field modality. Palace modality, it's got all that stuff, all the barriers up, all the glory, all the splendor, all the majesty, all that, right? And in the field, casual, more casual, less revelation, less glory. B, number two, the second distinction between the two modalities of field or palace is regarding the revelation itself. The revelation itself, not the level of revelation, not the degree of revelation. Everyone would agree that a more glorious kind of revelation happens in the palace. But the broadness of the revelation itself takes place primarily in the field, because more people see the king. In other words, the broadness of the expansion of the revelation itself happens primarily in the field. When the king is in his palace, quote, one may only enter his presence with permission. Let's turn the page to 340. And this is granted only to the nation's elite and to a select few. When he's in the palace, there's more beauty and more splendor, but the pool of those that are directly seeing it, not the reputation. The reputation, everyone knows of the king's reputation. Everyone knows about the king. But those that are actually seeing the king in his glory, only a select few. And that actually builds the glory of the king, because only a select few see it. When, by contrast, he's in the field, then, as we have in the parable, anyone who so desires is given the license and the opportunity to go out and greet him. He receives them all pleasantly and shows a smiling countenance to them all. So here the Rebbe is pointing out in his discourse from 1966, the Rebbe is pointing out the following. When you compare the reality of the king in the palace, of the king in the field, two salient points come to the surface. Number one, there's more beauty, grandeur, and splendor when the king is in the palace versus in the field. There's more accessibility when the king is in the field over the king in the palace. Make sense? Let's bring it back to God. Similarly, in the analog, the revelations of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when God is in the palace, so to speak, right? So the revelations of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and in a larger sense of the 10 days of tshuva, repentance as a whole, are comparable to the presence of a king in his palace. Rosh Hashanah, you have to show up. Rosh Hashanah, we show up to synagogue. And Yom Kippur, we blow the shofar, and we do the things we need to do, and we pray for a good year, and a happy year, and a healthy year, and a sweet year, and a blessed year. And Yom Kippur, we again pray, and we fast, and we're showing up and we're trying to gain access. And the last prayer, famously, of Yom Kippur is called, what's the last prayer of Yom Kippur called? Ne'ilah. Let's eat. No, after the prayer, we say, let's eat. No, that's not what the prayer is called. The last prayer is called, the last prayer is called Ne'ilah. And what is Ne'ilah? The closing, the locking of the gates, right? The chamber is a little bit open. The royal chamber is a little bit open. On Yom Kippur, a little bit open, but then gates are closing. You got to get in before the sun sets. So on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we call them days of awe, days of Yomim and Noraim. They're days of awe and, in a sense, almost fear and subjugation to God, so to speak. So it's like the king in the palace. So these days, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the 10 days of Tshuva, are comparable to the presence of a king in his palace. In such an instance, in other words, in that case, at those times, the revelation of God in his palace, so to speak, the king in the palace, arouses a person's emotional reaction like a king in his palace who wears regal garments and the royal crown and thus casts dread and fear upon those who enter his court, if you were able to be granted access. So it's because the king is in the royal chambers and wearing the royal garments that casts dread and fear and awe and that splendor, that majesty, it actually affects the person on a very, very, in a very tangible way, the beholder of such the experience. That all happens Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Nevertheless, for a person to feel the revelation of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, in other words, for that to actually be sensed and felt, let's turn the page to 341. It is fundamentally necessary for it to be preceded by divine service in Elul. In other words, if you want to really feel the majesty and feel the power of the high holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, so we need to do the work that we need to do in the preceding month, the month that we're in right now, the month of Elul. Through such efforts of Elul, he becomes one of the nation's elite and the select few who enter the king's palace. How are you granted access to enter the chamber of the palace on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? It's through the work that we do in improving ourselves 30 days prior. That's how we get the all-access pass to the royal palace. So here's what it means. Anyone can show up in synagogue or, you know, in any context on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur and have a connection, have an experience. But if you really want to feel the full experience and really feel an emotional connection and transformed in a sense because of that glory and splendor and awe and majesty of the high holidays, the more you prepare for it in the 30 days preceding, the more El is a serious time of preparation, spiritual preparation. You know, in internal preparation, introspection, etc. The more we take the month of El seriously, the more impactful the high holidays will be. Rosh Hashanah will be lifted up to a higher level, Yom Kippur on a higher level, etc. That's how we become the nation's elite and the select few, quoting the parable. That's what we become the royal minister, so to speak, who can enter the king's palace and have that face to face. So that's all the king in the palace. The king in the palace is very select. You have to work to get in. But once you're in, you get the full majesty, and that affects you in a very real way. That lifts you up. The revelation of El, by contrast, is comparable to a king in the field. In other words, godliness is manifest in a manner that the revelation does not actually arouse a person, but only makes possible this divine service. In the month of El, the king is in the field. And when the king is in the field, when God is in the field, so to speak, what it means is God is saying, I'm available if you want. It's still on you to want it, but I'm letting you know I'm available. The rest of the year, a person might say, well, God is not available, so then why should I even bother? The month of El, God says, I'm in the field. I'm available. You still have to want it. You still have to show up to where the king is in the field. But the king is saying, I am in the field. It's like Lahavda, like to create a massive separation, obviously, between creator and any other analogy that we're going to give. But like, imagine you have like an author in a bookstore, in a coffee shop with a meet and greet. So the author of a book is there and available. And between the hours of 7 and 10, they're going to do a reading from the book and sign copies of the book. So they're making themselves available, but you still have to want to show up and be there. You still have to make the effort, and take the initiative and go out and be there. They're making themselves available, but you still have to do the work to get there. And so, again, lahavdil, to separate it, obviously, but God makes himself available to us all year round, but it's even more felt, the accessibility and the availability, in the month of Elul. But even that availability and accessibility is not doing it for us. It's enabling us to be able to do it on our own. It's making it easier for us to do it on our own by making it so accessible and so possible. However, let's continue. The capacity to initiate this divine service is granted to everyone, even the most distant, not to the exclusive individuals that are able to enter the chamber of the palace, but this permission is granted to everyone, even the one who's the most distant from the king. This concept is illustrated by the analogy of the king in the field. Let's continue 342. We're going to finish this chapter in just a few minutes. When the king is in such a state and setting without his crown and regal garments, here it's clearly specified. So when the king is in such a state and setting without his crown and regal garments, he does not cast dread and fear on those who see him. Like we were talking about before, right? When the king is in the field, you're not existentially afraid.
It's not being severe.
It's not a severity. It's not an awe and a dread and a fear. And like, it doesn't have that. That whole emotional heaviness to it. The king is in the field and he's smiling and he's happy and he's receiving everyone. Everyone is invited. No one's pulling you. No one's telling you you have to come. The king is not going to your house and saying, come, meet me for lunch. It's not happening. The king is in the field, accessible. You have to do the work. But the king is going to welcome everybody and anybody without the heaviness of a Tishrei. The high holidays, a lot of people show up to synagogue, but a lot of people feel it's a heavy time. The sermons are heavy. I mean, they don't have to be. Just, I mean, not here. We kind of keep it, you know, fun and engaging. Right, fun, whatever, like open and engaging. But a lot of times, sermons are heavy, and the mood and the atmosphere is like, it's like, who will live and who will die and who will this and who, like, it's very heavy. Rosh Hashanah, it's signed, and Yom Kippur, it's sealed. Who will be born? Like, all of this stuff, it's very heavy. That's the king in the palace, heavy. The king in the field is different. It's lighter. The king is smiling. The king is greeting everyone with a pleasant countenance, shining face. And the king is making himself accessible to anyone. It doesn't matter who you are and what you did. No access needed, no special swipe card, no special keys, nothing. Given full access, no matter who you are, full access. So again, from 342 at the top, when the king is in such a state and setting, without his crown and regal garments, he does not cast dread and fear on those who see him, and particularly not on the people found in the field, who are on a low level and thus cannot perceive the king's inner greatness. Moreover, when the king is in such a state and setting, he does not even arouse a desire for the people to come and greet him. The king's presence in the field does not naturally pull at the people to see him. He's making himself available, but he's not schlepping anyone. This concept is reflected in the words of the discourse in Likutei the Torah, where the parable comes from, where it says, anyone who so desires to go out and greet him, i.e. going out to greet the king, is primarily dependent on their own desire. It says, anyone who so desires is granted permission and can go out and greet him, but it's so desires. It's your desire. It's our desire. God is not doing the desiring for us. It's like a seesaw. The more God is in the palace, locked away, the more grandeur it is, the more awe there is, the more heaviness there is, the more it draws a person, the more it pulls a person, the more it sucks someone in. The less you have of that, right? The more accessible God is, the less God is schlepping, but the more available it is to everyone. Let's turn the page. Finally, the final few lines over here of this chapter, 343. Nevertheless, even though God is not drawing us in this month, or the king is not schlepping people because of the royalty, because of all of the layers, the king is not pulling us to the field. Nevertheless, the possibility that is granted to greet the king results from his being in the field. The bottom line is, the king, by being in the field, is giving the possibility for the people to greet him. Then, when the king is in the field, everyone has the license and the capacity to greet him. So here we have the parable of the king in the field, and what it does is it evokes both parts of this equation. Number one, The possibility is there for us to go greet him. But number two, God is not pulling us. God is not hand-holding us. God is not leading us to him. God is saying, I'm here for you, and I'm making myself available for you, but you need to do the work. I told you at the beginning of the class, the theme today is going to be how to inspire someone to be self-motivated. The real question is, how do you make yourself available? Or how do you make the conditions available, open and available for someone to take an initiative? That's the tricky balance. The more you inspire it, the more you do, the less it's them. The more you're doing, the less they're doing. But if you don't do anything, then they may not feel like they're capable at all of doing anything. So what the king in the field is teaching us, that this parable, this analogy, the way it's explained in this discourse, is teaching us about a wonderful balance here, where the king is making himself available and accessible, but the desire and the work and the effort and the movement is coming from the people. So he's making himself available, but it's coming from the people. This is a powerful lesson. We don't have time now to wrap it up, but I'll just tell you, this is a powerful lesson and message for education, raising children, grandchildren, motivating people, whether it's workers or co-workers or whoever, neighbors, community, on any different level. It's a powerful tool. The idea is that people, it's healthy when people do things initiating from themselves. Otherwise, they're not really doing it. They don't feel good about it. You don't feel good about it. No one feels good about you doing stuff for them or pulling some. That never works. So the key is that people are doing it themselves. But how do you motivate? How do you get someone to feel comfortable to doing it themselves? Or how do you give someone the confidence? It's all about laying out a scenario, a platform where they feel empowered and accepted and proficient enough to do it on their own. That's what the king in the field does. The king in the field is allowing people to feel comfortable to make that approach. The king, and as we'll continue in chapter 4, I have another booklet ready to go for next time. As we'll continue in chapter 4, the king smiling and showing a pleasant face, that itself encourages people to do it on their own because they know they'll be embraced with love. Like Alex said before, creating a loving atmosphere, a welcoming, accepting atmosphere is one of the greatest catalyst, it sounds like you're doing it, but it's the one of the great enablers for a person to do it on their own. When they feel like they can do it, and they'll be loved for it, and embraced by it, and accepted for it, and they feel like they can be successful because you're encouraging them to do it on their own, that's the greatest way. The heaviness and the harshness doesn't usually work as a motivator, but that open enabling and that love, that unconditional love, which we'll see in chapters 4 and 5, that truly brings out the best within the other person to allow them to step up to the plate and achieve their potential. Thank you very much for joining me this morning for Kabbalah and Coffee.